Today I give in the morning my talk about biopolitics versus freedom. In the afternoon I speak about the master narrative, the European master narrative is again about freedom. Freedom is the topic. In the morning I think the result is going to give a talk about metrics of personality. This I think is very important. I will touch upon the issue of the capital already on Thursday. Tomorrow, in the morning, I'm going to talk about the role of emotions in the reception of works of art. And then, George Darwin will give a lecture on my conception of humanism. And in the afternoon, the Thursday in the afternoon, I'm going to speak about two pillars of modern ethics, in which I will also return to the question discussed by Katie today, the ethics of personality, and also the problem of constitution, which will be on the agenda today in the afternoon. Friday will be a special day, because in the morning at 10 o'clock I give my lecture on what is postmodern identified this after. But afterwards, I think instead of giving an additional lecture, it would be good to collect from you all your questions and make and organize a discussion with you all. That is, you could write your questions in Catalanian or Spanish, and someone is going to translate the question, or you can ask someone to translate the question into English. But anyway, you can ask questions for all three of us, that is, for people, including myself, and it's Friday, it's interpreted or not. This is the possible problem. If you have other wishes, you can express your wishes. Of course, I wanted to tell you what is in my mind, and that is some other thing that is also in your mind.
Ask them to give me the question in that case of the perspective.
Yeah. Thank you. So the topic of today is biopolitics versus freedom, a new chapter in the history of world controversy. Now I try to read because then I'm on the short side, not to jump out of time. So the concept of biopolitics sums up various developments, slogans, political ideas and practices, which have one thing in common, namely all politicize the body. In addition, they appear roughly at the same time. Biopolitics is a modern kind of politics, but it is also questionable whether we can speak about politics at all. This is why I use the terminology politicizing of the body, not basically politics of the body. One can politicize the body from several perspectives, sometimes even from conflicting perspective, and all of them have to do something with the concept of nature. That is, all of them wants to interpret or understand what is nature and what is not, what is natural and what is not natural, and this decision about the question what is natural and non-natural becomes politicized in biopolitics. Now, I speak about biopolitics answering different questions. First, the first group of questions can be formulated in the following way. Can we interfere with nature? Can we change nature? Does change in nature benefit men, or rather the opposite is the case? To what extent politics can interfere with nature, and to what extent it should remain the prerogative of the single individual to change birth or his born nature. That's the first question. Whether we can distinguish between what nature is and whether we can interfere with nature, whether it's a right or wrong thing to interfere with nature. This is the first question. Second, the second question can be interpreted in the following way. Can we, should we, identify ourselves on the ground of our biological constitution, or at least on the ground of one conspicuous feature of our biological constitution? Should we constitute our identities on the ground of biological features, such as sex and race? How far such biological features exist in fact naturally? Third question. The third question concerns desires and needs. Are there natural and unnatural desires? Can politics, or rather should politics, interfere with human desires and needs? Can it make us happy? Next, the fourth group of questions concerns priorities. The tradition of repeating well-being and living well has not disappeared since it reappears around the modern politics of the body, not just in some of them, but in all of them. And the question of living, the conflict between good life and well-being, the conflict at least in all questions concerning the politicizing of the body. So I start now with the first question. The first group of questions sounds as follows. Can we interfere with nature? Can we change nature? Does changing nature benefit us or others of us? To what extent can politics interfere with nature? And to what extent it should be the prerogative of the single individual to decide? In fact, it was Michel Foucault who first coined the word biopolitics, and he pointed at the historical moment when biopolitics came into being. This was the historical moment that natural catastrophes were no more regarded as divine punishment or entirely irrational, incomprehensible events. That was the time of the dawn of sciences, of the dawn of the conception that maybe we can control somehow this kind of natural catastrophes. And we cannot attribute them anymore to divine punishment, which we cannot do anything about, but to natural forces, the operation of natural forces, and this is why we can prevent this kind of natural catastrophes happening. That is the man's task, is to prevent catastrophes of nature happening, but the natural catastrophes are not man-dependent. Man has is not the cause of the natural catastrophes. Now, if you are familiar with contemporary debate, somehow modern ecology returns to the ancestors, because now we say that man is also responsible for natural catastrophes. Man should have done what man has done in order to prevent natural catastrophes. In a way, we are returning to the program that we have seen for, because we disobey divine laws, but simply because we disobey the laws of nature. And this is one sin we have committed, and now we have to prevent the most terrifying conclusions of this sin. Now, when politics starts to cope with the problem of biology and natural catastrophes and other kind of biological events and phenomena, then they decide what is good for politics and what is problematic from the position of politics. This is called by Foucault governmentability, and this which increases the concept of sovereignty. So wherever politics puts a premium, for example, on population increase, which is a new biological thing, it will exercise demographic contour in this direction. And if, in contrast, the population decrease is on the political agenda, like now in China, it politicizes the practice of birth control. In China, you cannot have more than one child. All other children have to be aborted, because that's to say, the state exercises very strong politics of the body in birth control. Health services are also politically targeted in one or the other direction. The international, multinational, political agencies and also national movements normally combine traditional and modern elements. I told you that they blame the sins of people because they were happy in the process of national catastrophes, but at the same time they also believe that we have to prevent these national catastrophes from happening if we interfere. Not necessarily in nature, but we interfere into the interference of man into nature. That is a new conception. Since Foucault, that biopolitics of this kind has expanded in then still unknown territories of gene manipulation, cloning, etc., bioscience and bioethics are already informing biopolitics. It is not just an ethical, but also a politically contested question how far genetic manipulation should be permitted by law. For example, genetic manipulation of plants, of animals, of the human embryo, and so on. For example, you cannot import into Europe genetically changed beer, for example, because the European Union legislated. That's also of course, biopolitics. Yet politics is expected to interfere or not to interfere in seemingly simple matters such as euthanasia. Should passive or active euthanasia be permitted? Has the individual right to die? Has the individual freedom to decide when to die? What is then natural? Is epidemics or famine natural? The question can be specified. Does being natural mean that its being or birthing is independent of human error or act? So this is the definition of natural. You can understand that natural is, but the development of which is totally independent of any kind of human intervention. This is natural. If specified in this way, almost nothing is natural, except perhaps the jungle, rainforest, and perhaps the virgin desert. Because everywhere, but it's nature, there are the signs, the results of human intervention everywhere, in the wind everywhere. But one can also say that everything is natural, where the relations between causes and effects develop in organic or inorganic matter, but if this is so, everything is natural. Cloning is also natural, because the capacity to clone is in our brain is natural. Nuclear reactors are too natural, because the capacity to invent nuclear reactors is the capacity of brain, which is very natural. So basically, there is nothing which is not natural. What is natural, what is not natural, is therefore a matter of decision. Because if you say everything which is independent of human intervention is natural, then nothing is natural. And if you say everything which follows the cause and effect, which is a natural cause of effect, then everything is natural. In clothing is natural, in nuclear bomb is natural, everything is natural. So, in order to distinguish what is natural and not natural, you have a decision to make. It is always a matter of decision. But all decisions can be political. For example, when there is famine in one part of the world, citizens of rich states can say that it is just natural. By which they mean that the population of the poor country did not take proper measures to prevent famine, for example, birth control. Others can be told that it is not natural at all, because it was the inclusion of Western non-natural technology. technology which made those people abandon their old forms of life and causes the trauma. In most cases, the premium, that is a biological phenomenon, gets politicized. It would be a very different proposition to say we have a moral obligation for those who suffer, because we do not suffer from the same in the family. If we said this, we spoke about moral obligation to help those who suffer, we would recommend a politics of solidarity instead of biopolitics. If I speak the language of solidarity, I do not need to distinguish between natural and non-natural, so I do not need to invoke the ideological constructions of biopolitics. Or, cloning can succeed because it is natural, let's say. If it is not natural, because it is generally accepted that there is no cloning without human intervention. But if this is not natural, then caesarean section is also unnatural because of human intervention. Healing is unnatural because of human intervention. Irrespective whether you believe it works, can, or synthetically produce medicine, all healing is human intervention. It is not natural. But if political intervention depends on the decision taken concerning biological nature, what is natural and what is not, and the decision becomes a definition, a so-called fact, on the ground of which actions will be taken, which programs formulated, which institutions established, which policies designed, we will end up at the politicizing the body. And this happens all the time. But it is not necessary to decide about the natural, neither to argue in behalf of it or against it. There needs to be a kind of bioethics which does not cling to the unresolvable issue whether something is natural or not, whether we offend nature, for example, creating testing days. But, so the argument runs, the political body carries responsibility for the welfare of all citizens and should politicize the issue. Whether and versus freedom eventually infringes the freedom of the wealthy or the wealthy of the others. This is necessary, yet a general political question, and as such not specified on issues concerning the body. But it applies also for example, at the manipulation at the stock market. Here too, the argument switches from the protection of nature, that is, in this case, biological life, to the issues of good life. But attention, no politics can positively further good life. It can only remove several, even if not all, obstacles from living a good life. For only the single person, a good person is a good citizen, in his or her autonomy, can positively further his or her own good life. Let me give a provisional answer to the question concerning the first group of problems. The concept of nature, natural, is paradox. But it's justified to say that nature has always been transformed and changed, as well as also justified to say that we never change nature, neither the external or the internal one. We change only its use and its understanding. But whether we are close to the first or the other side of the paradox, we can perhaps agree that the question whether something is natural or not natural, in the above discussed cases at least, where nature and artifact, nature and man-induced are contrasted, is and remains the matter of decision. And it is better if not the political authorities decide. And it is better if political priorities are not based on the determination of an unresolvable problem. But fully aware of the paradox, valuable the concept of nature, it will be decided on the ground of the concept of good life in autonomy and solidarity. Of course, that's not the future. The second group of problems. The second, that was the first one. The second group of problems about biopolitics focuses on the question of group identity formation, as to whether group identity should be constituted around clear or imagined shared biological bodily characteristics. Instead of quoting Foucault, now allow me to refer to my own book, Biopolitics Written Together with Ferenc Fehér, where we paid special attention to the identity constituting employment of biopolitics. That's different. It's not, we don't distinguish between natural and non-natural, we distinguish between groups, the identical groups on the ground of their biological features. The second group of problems appeared historically at the same time as those belonging to the first group. Pre-modern societies were all older, different men as hierarchically organized, where the functions performed by single men and women depended on the very place where they had been thrown at the time of their birth. They belonged to their estate. Belonging to one or the other estate was considered to be natural. Yet naturalness was not directly related to biological characteristics. True, higher aristocracy was supposed to have a so-called blue blood. Yeah? But this was meant symbolically, of course. The almost invisible gap between members of the different estates were rather cultural. They ranged from language use, religion, to the way men and women walked, the dress they wore, to their eating and drinking habits, entertainment, and so on. Race became an issue in early modernity during the first waves of colonization, when the white race started to claim superiority. It is from this age onwards when biological identification started to play a role, namely the role of exclusion. To give a simple example, the European Christian anti-Judaism assumed a racist character first time in history in Spain, exactly during the decades of the conquest of America, that is at the dawn of modernity, the first time when anti-Judaism became racist. That was in the end of the 15th century here. To cut a long story short, the 19th century and early 20th century was the age of the parvenus, the age of assimilation. It goes together with the problem of biopolitics. That is, the most ambitious members of certain ethnic groups and classes which had been treated as inferior began to assimilate to the behavior and customs ethnic groups and classes which were regarded as superior. This happened simultaneously with the expansion of citizenship, with the opening of possibilities of working value of poor citizens. Yet, the ethically suspect and frequently unsuccessful option was accompanied also by collective actions to make use of the slower opening possibility. There were avenues of solidarity on class basis, in trade unions and social democratic parties, at least in Europe, if hardly anywhere else. And there is nothing to do with racism and biological constitution. And even in Europe, for reasons which cannot be discussed in this lecture, biological identification and group constitution has soon gained momentum. Racism as a modern ideology is in fact a European product. Ethnic differences became perceived as race differences, and in addition, politically increasing manipulated by political leaders and parties. The emergence of Nazism was just the most devastating and lethal form of politics based on race identity, the ideology of racism, which is identity politics. Anyway, Hannah Arendt discussed it very beautifully in her book, Origins of Totalitarianism. Race politics and politics of oppression and terror has been repeatedly placed after Second World War in a different kind of race identity politics of a different agenda. The, idolatry was what in France by Lévi-Strauss and also by Sartre. The conception was as follows. If a group of people has been oppressed by the colonizers on the ground of a racist ideology, they can liberate themselves with the use of the same ideology. This is what Sartre called the radicalization of evil. Counterpolitics is a kind of politics where the identity of the group of actors is constituted by biological, bazaar region, or natural features, became the political agenda for the oppressed or for the previously oppressed. Biopolitics, however, showed its most problematic features very soon, also in those quarters. For if one begins to identify oneself in the group by biological features, one can constitute as many ethnic groups or races as one wants. One can constitute every tribe as a separate race and politically organize hostilities against the others. In America, in the 80s and the 90s, group identities were formed mostly on the ground of racial, quasi-racial, ethnic, and quasi-ethnic characteristics. This agenda has been called identity politics and became also common practice in feminist movements. In Europe, various formerly coexisting ethnic groups, seen conservatives and Croats, Serbs and Croats, have started to make war against one another and started to define themselves as separate races. People divorced each other because after 20 years of marriage, they discovered that one is a Croat and the other is a Serbian. And if it does not incite environments or other kinds of hostilities, party formation often follow real principles and the grouping. All these kinds of politics are manifestations or other versions of biopolitics. What does it mean? I speak about a manipulation of ethnic and race differences, that ethnic differences also perceived as if they were race differences. What does it mean that ethnic and race differences are politically manipulated? Who manipulates those differences? And for what purpose? By manipulation, instrumentalization, I mean the reinforcement of certain group differences, meaning of cultural differences, of tradition or local hostilities or grudges with the level of massive ideologies. That is the point we explained again. They then interact, divide and rule. Yet the third party manipulation of the divine and rule type, in order to be successful, needs to find already first and second party manipulations on the religious set. Such first and second order manipulations, the work of opinion leaders, I call them ethnocrats, self-made men emerging from the heart of ethnic and cultural groups who forge group identity on the ground of bodily resemblance and initiate the politics of hostility against other groups whose leaders, on their part, busy themselves with the same. They create a political space in the spirit of country in a specific manner. This is hostility between us and them, between me and the other. It is constituted on ethnic or race grounds. Mediation becomes impossible. So you can't mediate if the difference is constitute another the ground of political programs or political goals or agendas of certain kind of needs they want to satisfy. But if hostility is constituted on race ground or quasi-race ground, then mediation becomes impossible. You see, if there is a working class movement and the workers want a higher wage, and that the capitalists that don't want to give them this high wage, then they can sit down and they can end up with a kind of compromise. But if the conflict is constituted on race grounds, no compromise is possible because they are by definition and they are different people as such, and they cannot go into any kind of compromise. Mediation is impossible. And hostility is constantly reinforced itself. Ethnocrats produce ideology, mostly racist, for quasi-racist ideology, for their group through the diabolization of God, not just as an alien, but also as a hostile, threatening, and evil entity. Ceremonial, almost liturgical celebration of that self, orgies of choreography, of hatred, are the collective ego dreams. The third party is just uses the second and first party as for its purpose, and adds fuel to the fire of the least very curious passions. The advocates or opinion leaders whose ideology forced the group coherence are normally products, unfortunately, of mass universities. The abnormally self-made men who consciously make use of ideological manipulation, even if they believe occasionally in what they appreciate, what is not necessary is also the case. What is national and what is not? The ethnocrats decide what national is. For them, the enemy is always the national enemy. That's also Kashmir. Biopolitics as identity politics constantly collides with needs for freedom. Although in some cases, as mentioned, racial or pseudo-racial characteristics as basis of group identification can serve the cause of liberation. I do not deny this. And especially the betterment of life chances of the fate of certain oppressed or formerly oppressed groups of people, they can never serve the cause of freedom. So I distinguish between liberation and freedom. And I am not this one. Liberation leads to freedom only under the condition that as a result of liberation, liberties are constituted by the citizens of a country. This is also an idea. Biopolitical identity formation cannot reside in citizens' freedom, nor in individual freedom. Let me enumerate a few reasons. On the ground of biological identity politics, the single individual is in duty bound to swallow the world opinion in order to strengthen collective identity. On the ground of biological identity politics, one has to accept exclusively out of representation and exclude hetero representation. For example, Hungary cannot be represented by Romania, neither politically nor in Europa. Since bioidentity politics is forged by opinion leaders and ethnocrats, biologically constituted group identities are always endangered by the acceptance of the Führer principle, even in democracy, yet normally they result in tyrannies. Further on, one has to give preference for the well-being of one's own group, even against justice. Finally, one cannot choose multiple identities or give at least an absolute preference for one identity, the biological, as against all the others. That's all together. All the inherited features of bioidentity politics result in a kind of fundamentalism. From this, it does not follow that only biopolitics is or can be fundamentalist. Actually, all identity has a strong affinity to fundamentalism. I come to the third one. The sort of questions of the politics of the body concerns desires. The distinction between natural and non-natural desires is nowadays expanded into the distinction between natural and non-natural needs. The control of desires, the handling of desires, the cannibalization thereof is as old as the human race. Yet this is not an issue here. For desires used to be controlled, thematized, and repressed by community rules, ethics, and religion, and not in politics. For example, being politics had nothing to do with desires, it was ethics, religion, and philosophy, which maintained the common norm, nothing in much. The control of desires becomes a political problem when the control of needs becomes a problem. This is the case first in the so-called paternalism. Perhaps the Roman Empire practiced for the first time paternalism and most of absolute monarchy resuscitated it in the spirit of the modern Hobbes in Russia. According to Hobbes and similar great singers of modern times, the sovereign has not just the right, but also the obligation to care for the happiness of the subjects. It must make subjects happy, or at least prevent them from being unhappy. Perhaps if necessary, also against these inclinations and erratic behavior. The problem that is solved by living the time of enlightenment, whether he has the right to make his people happy against their will, summarizes the problem of this kind of power politics. Happiness, happy life, is thus no more a matter of ethics, but directly political issue. And if the sovereign state has the obligation to make people happy, to feed, to take care for health and longevity, it has also the prerogative to forbid them to do things which would make them unhappy. Or in the satisfaction of right, good, really means make them happy, whereas anger, bad, perverted means make them unhappy. As a result, the satisfaction of those perverted, bad, unruly should be forbidden, and the desires related to those needs repressed. That is, the sovereign decides. The sovereign decides distinguishes all seven social classes, and he decides, for example, as to whether education is a real need or not, and for whom yes and for whom not. That the distinction between natural and artificial needs is made matter again of political decision, of political ideology. Artificial needs should not be satisfied, rather persecuted. The idea that the state, even if it cannot make people happy, must prevent them from making themselves unhappy, never ever disappeared for good in the history of modern states. There were extreme cases like some totalitarian societies with their absolute dictatorship over means. Yet if the utilitarian idea to promote the greatest happiness of the greatest numbers is present in most democratic societies. True, paternalism expands further than the politics of the body, but the politics of the body plays the first field here. After all, the state does not interfere with one's need for certain kinds of art, although sometimes it does, unless it concerns desires. Yes, I heard, of course, that Dover must disclose the 78 in Iran, it was in Iran previously, because the leadership decided the female voice is very attractive and dangerous for the desire of men, so you cannot have opera play. So this is what I mean. That is a very extreme case. If opera is out all because of the dangerous female voice may cause for men's desires. It's an extreme case. But less extreme cases happen all the time. What is considered natural, what is not, is so much a matter of perception that it changes everywhere. But all the time, the state has the duty to prevent the citizens' eyes from evil. We all remember the abolitionist Frank Lurie in the history of America, where it was decided that the consumption of alcoholic beverage prevents me from being happy and needs to be prohibited for that reason. This is my need, that is, my need for alcoholic beverage was considered as unnatural by the state. That is, you need for alcoholic beverage, whether you have this need or not, was decided by the state. Today, the need for grass smoking remains unacknowledged, and cigarette smoking is forbidden in public places because it is considered poisonous. My question is not whether smoking is healthy or unhealthy, only that biopolitics transforms problems of personal health into political issues. If I prefer shorter life, this is my business. As my question is not whether abortion is right or wrong, but that this ethical, this religious issue is transformed into a political one. The state, though the quality, through the qualities of your body, prevents us not from being everywhere, but it prevents us from being unhappy. Let me return to the question of enlightenment. It did not sound as to whether the sovereign can or should make us happy, but whether it should make us happy against our will. The answer of man of enlightenment was ambiguous. The conflict between happiness and freedom should be decided in favor of freedom. Freedom must always have the priority as against happiness. Not just because it should be at the liberty of the citizen, which are the needs they prefer to satisfy, but for another important reason as well. The state can warrant for the citizen's freedom, at least political freedom. Yet the state cannot, absolutely not, warrant their happiness. I repeat, the state can warrant political freedom for the citizens, but the state cannot warrant happiness. That's a false claim. Freedom of the citizen is a political matter, whereas happiness is a personal, individual, even subjective matter. Liberty means that I can exercise my rights if I want to, and the Republic can fully establish this right. Happiness, using the same scheme, would mean that I can be happy if I want to, and this is just bad nonsense. The satisfaction of all needs is nonsense, unless the state decides about the needs and desires which can be satisfied. This is exactly what I mean by the dictatorship over needs, the extreme version of biopolitics of the third time. No politics can make man happy at all. Enlightenment rejected biopolitics of all sorts in an absolute confidence to a Republican constitution. Still, the issue became more complicated than it seemed. So I want to show that there are always certain things which are right, that certain problems that are real problems formulated in biopolitics. All the solutions suggested are all wrong. Still, the issue became more complicated than it seemed. The leading idea of the modern world is equal opportunity. Yet there is no equal opportunity in fact. Whenever the citizens of a state make clear for justice, there is also clear to the narrowing of the gap between the idea and reality. The gap cannot be closed, yet it needs to be narrower continuously. To cut the long story short, redistribution of opportunities is on the agenda through the redistribution of wealth in different forms. The politics of redistribution is, however, not like politics, although it is the politics of relative equalization of life chances. No biological identities are formed, neither are needs and desires determined. The politics of fair redistribution, of relative equalization of life chances, does not require the distinction between natural and non-natural, even between natural and non-natural needs. Republican social politics does not claim to make people happy, only that diminished opportunities should not make people unable to pursue in their own way also their private happiness. This is, of course, on the model to make it perceptible that promote relative equality of life chances is no biopolitics. That is, I mean, that is, to promote relative equality of life chances is no biopolitics, since normally governments, as also intellectuals, try to interfere also with the desires and needs of citizens. It becomes biopolitics only if governments and intellectuals, ideologists, try to interfere also in the desires and needs of citizens and tell them what their real needs are, what would make them happy or unhappy. Well, in this case, we will become the dream for the redistribution of wealth, becoming biopolitics of sorts. Intellectuals and cultural politics can, of course, say what they want, yet not governments, only individuals need, if they need to listen you can say that, right? We can also distinguish between you and false teeth and all that, like this. This is a matter of public discourse. But the person does not need to listen to you. But if it makes, is making law, he cannot help listening to you. And that's a very, very difficult. Now, one to the third question four. Here I write to the fourth last group of questions concerning priorities. Immediately, I need to correct or underline the previous sentence, namely, it is true that good life is an ethical matter and has nothing to do with biopolitics. Yet it is also true that in the modern perception of good life, it is frequently identified, or almost identified, with life, good and simple. And if this is the case, politics of good life can also assume features of biopolitics, I repeat. So I say that good life has nothing to do with life, good and simple. Life, good and simple, and the concept of good life are different concepts. However, if in a society, majority or great part of minority, in fact identifies good life with well-being, then biopolitics becomes also politics concerning the concept of good life. I think that the enormous difference between poor and rich countries is especially conspicuous in this period. Whereas in poor countries, mere survival of a family with children, that is life maintenance, is itself a victory over life. In rich countries, claims raised that human biology are not just enormous and constantly increasing, but begin to enjoy an absolute priority. The body, the maintenance of the body, the care of the body, becomes an obsession. This is the case when well-being is identified with good life. I give you some examples of the contemporary life. The phenomena I refer to are very known. Thus, it's life is good only to refer to them. Let me start with obsession of longevity. Of course, we know that we are going to die. We know that we are going to die. But we cease to think of it. Immortality is, in fact, an old and absolute need everyone in human planet shares this need. But our obsession with longevity is entirely different from the image of immortality of the soul, or the transmigration of the soul, or the resurrection of the dead. It is the dream, moreover the effort, towards the elongation of this worldly bodily presence. Who knows, perhaps ad infinitum. There are scientific fantasies about hibernation which may come through, and so by. There is a competition for longevity. Whoever dies younger must have made a terrible mistake, that by bad diet, neglect of jogging, or perhaps the habit of cigarette smoking. Women are today frequently also men get facelifts to look younger, but if they look younger, they also feel, or at least are supposed to be younger. The strength of body, about the body, is no more needed for a feminine human or a poor animal. You don't need a strong body anymore, and a minor bigger animal. As well, thus it becomes also an obsession in case of bodybuilding. The obsession with health and longevity influences also deeply the sense of human beauty. Enemy girls are considered to be beautiful, just as entirely disproportionate bodies of bodybuilders. In fact, the care for the body, for longevity, for youth and health, becomes the ethical issue number one. The person who smokes, who is fat, who rather sleeps in the morning than jogs, is a sinner, a target of justified moral censure. Or at least, she is considered sick, the victim of false, bad, sinful needs and desires which need to be purged. There is much sickness, pain, suffering, also in the life of the denizens of the modern world. Biopolitics of this fourth time is also just an attempt to cope with transiency, to make human life better, to increase popular religion and belief, or to amend it. It is the life of forgetfulness. Not forgetfulness of being, as Heidegger would have said it, but forgetfulness of transiency, of contingency, that without great effort. It makes seeking spirituality unbounded. Thinking sense of life without much personal seeking, without spirituality, requires activity, moreover, constant and feverish activity. The second, the third, and the fourth clusters of biopolitics initiate and regulate just such a feverish activity. The activity of pursuing identity politics, the activity of the care of the self as a needing and being body alone. Managing circulates around the body, and I repeat, life is not identified with good life. I can only repeat that biopolitics is modern. All the four clusters of any kind of biopolitics are modern. Yet the issue which is at stake is by no means also modern. The conflict between life, survival, and good life on the one hand, and the attempt to identify sheer life with good life, the constant refusal or rebuttal of this identification on the one hand is perhaps as long as civilization. So I repeat, there is a story here which is involved in biopolitics, which is however a very, very old story. This is the story between Verdi, a conflict between Verdi and freedom. The conflict between Verdi and freedom is a very, very old story, as long as our civilization. I call it what I want to repeat that biopolitics is modern and the story is old. Let me now turn to ancient texts to show this common picture. The first text can be found in the Bible, in the book of Exodus. The conflict between need satisfaction and freedom, that is between freedom and happiness, as it will be formulated much later during the times of enlightenment, is already dramatically staged. The people of Israel, liberated from the Egyptian slavery, cannot endure the hardship of freedom and desires to return to slavery to free itself from the flesh pots of Egypt. The conflict peaks in the sea of the golden calf, so wonderfully presented in Schoenberg's opera, Moses and Aaron. When Moses is very close to God to receive the law, the people report, to satisfy the people's needs, Aaron let man all boil and let form the golden calf. That is, he made a body for God, or made God as a body. The people jubilated and celebrated the golden calf with orgy and drunkenness. Moses returns, slashes the slab of stone, punishes those considered guilty, yet not Aaron. In a dramatic encounter between Aaron and Moses, in Schoenberg's opera, Aaron argues in behalf of his policy. He believes that was the policy. He argues for it. If you want people to get into the promised land, says Aaron, you must make them happy. You must let them satisfy their needs. For otherwise, they will constantly remain in the desert. The freedom of the spirit is only thriving in exile, in the desert. Moses, of course, defends the great idea of the invisible, Almighty God, and the opera remains unfinished. The other classic texts I may refer to are the texts of Aristotle's lectures. The aim, the telos of living things is man. The telos of man is, on the one hand, a citizen, a free citizen, on the other hand, a thinking being. That are two telos of man, a citizen, yeah, as a man is a citizen, and as a thinking man, a man in the logos. The highest life is that of loose of the spirit. The tales of the cosmos is the pure form which is entirely void of matter. As only the animals are in control of our own desires, whereas in theoretical, speculative life, we are entirely absorbed in the highest. I talked about this conception already when we spoke about money and so on, as it was needed for yesterday. In both cases, freedom is just the cost of life, human and freedom. Freedom is identified mostly with political liberty and with the control of our interior needs and desires. Both. Israel has been liberated from Egypt. No king can rule it. Only the divine law, that is, they do not need to be a man who would stand above them, and so is the case in Aristotle, where the city takes the place of God. The city is the subtotal of all citizens. We obey self-created laws. We have to become and stay free, but must exercise strong control over one's own body and also own mind, insofar it needs our defenses for mere passions. Yet the control over the passions, either in obedience of the law or in absorbing the virtues of the city, is also freedom. It is another kind of freedom. Following our needs and desires, that is, well-being is neither freedom nor is it happiness. For so Aristotle said, we have to be virtuously steward our whole life to be happy. In the Bible, happiness is blessing, grace, thus we cannot contribute much to it on our own account. I mentioned, brethren, that the Moses Aaron conflict is frequently reportrayed in modern forms, yet perhaps never with such a great artistic force than in the dialogue between Christ and the great inquisitor in Dostoevsky's brother Karamazov. It is here that the gambit of the biblical Aaron, played by the great inquisitor, is not anti-legendary. In Dostoevsky, it's not anti-legendary. He presents a paradox here in brother Karamazov. In the afternoon, we turn to the Karamazov brothers' problem. Would life, the life of the spirit, moral life, unlike it to highest intensity, yet not in the broadest extensity, is thus considered always all the world of freedom. Good life, spiritual life, is meant to be a synthesis, the synthesis between value on the one hand and spirituality on the other, satisfaction of desires on the one hand, and the cultivation of subtle desires on the other hand. Good life is meaningful and rich, mere living is poor, brutal and empty. Again, a normal in one sense. It was the synthesis between the values of life and freedom which was interpreted in utmost irony by Nietzsche, and not without any grace. At the first approach, because Nietzsche seemed to treat the ascetic priest with unmitigated contempt. And with good instinct, he judged religious practices and philosophical conceptions of ethical practices alike. The ascetic priest, when the prophet or philosopher meets, according to Nietzsche, his body as an enemy, suspects all his bodily and natural desires with complicity to moral evil, as merely lowly matter. Nietzsche's outburst against the ascetic priest, his longing for life, written in capital F, appear in the first instance as many defenses of the kind of politics we today call biopolitics. Many authors, however, make the point that the biopolitical interpretation does not refer Nietzsche's conception of life, in his concept of race, does not refer at all to a biological or bodily determination. And this when Nietzsche speaks about life and he speaks about even about the race, it does not mean any kind of biological determination, and his ironical rejection of the aesthetic race does not go together with the kind of support for a kind of biopolitics which is not his point. We have to add to this his absolute commitment to life, written in capital N, and is a world apart from the normalization of mere survival, of well-being. In the controversy between Aaron and Moses, presented in the opera by Schoenberg, Nietzsche would absolutely take the side of Moses against Aaron. For the kind of value which one buys on the price of unfreedom is in Nietzsche's mind despicable, the life of the mob, of the crowd, of the world. He mostly addresses the logics of the life of free spirits. Does it only believe for one moment that Nietzsche may offer an alternative to the synthesis of spiritual life, human life, yet he does not. So the devil, we are left by the synthesis with the spiritual life and the life of the body, and the synthesis presents us rather in a paradox which is all paradoxes remain unresolved, and the solution of which is basically, as I said, a reformulation of the same paradox. The controversy between Maripas of Anhem in all forms and groups, and the qualities of citizenship, constitutional liberties, passions for freedom and spirituality, other than, is the repetition of the old and conspicuous contrast between elite and broad perhaps, and perhaps between soul and body. Perhaps you remember the first afternoon, perhaps it is basically the rethinking, reformulating of the conflict or the concept or a discord between soul and body. I think both yes and no. There was a prophet among the left, and his name was Karl Marx. He was the one who prophesied that all controversy between life and freedom will be overcome in a world called communism, the world of freedom, where all needs will be satisfied. And so Marx came up with the model, and he said, there is really a world of absolute freedom in which all needs are satisfied. And basically Marx gave us a proposition about the solution of both the sovereign nation. You can have both of them. You can have both of them. Only the world of necessity, the world of classic societies, class societies produce the controversy between freedom and need satisfaction. But in the future, the world of absolute abundance, in the world of absolute abundance, life and freedom will be absolutely reconciled. But this is not to be, since there is and remains scarcity. This is why. You cannot solve the balance, you cannot unite it. Because there is and remains scarcity. Scarcity in bread, scarcity in meaning, and also scarcity in love. And scarcity constantly reproduces the arrow versus controversy. It places men and women not before one single choice, but many consecutive choices. Mostly, there is an either or. And the possibility of the synthesis is only personal. That's, you cannot give a philosophical solution for the synthesis. It can be achieved only personally. Biopolitics is also an answer to the world's power of controversy, or to the champion antinomy between freedom and happiness. It is a modern answer to the question and the satisfying certain modern needs. My greatest problem with biopolitics is perhaps not even that it sides with the body against free judgment, with bio-identity against free choice and citizenry, with dictatorship of desires and advanced in the name of the body. But my greatest problem with biopolitics is the constant reinforcement of the discourse on nature and body. That is, the constant reinforce the discourse of nature and body, that nature and body, that is, the truth about nature and body, is constantly produced. Precisely because the discourse of biopolitics produces constantly the truth about our biological constitutions, our bio-identity, our naturalness, our needs and desires, our life and life in general, the truth thus produced prevents the masters of biopolitics as well as the following to become aware of what they are in fact doing and representing. They cannot keep distant from their own ideas, their truths. They are unaware of the controversy in which they participate. They do not see the dilemma. For them, there is no dilemma at all. That's my greatest problem. I'll try to discuss the four groups of biopolitical issues one by one. Needless to say, their main issues are mostly connected. Not always the standpoints, but certainly the issues. The most important common ground among them is not on the affirmative, but the negative pole, moreover, on the emotional pole. biopolitics in general feeds on fear and organizes fear. Fear of the mechanical modernity, fear of the destruction of past habitats, fear from the loss of certainties, fear of the loss of control, fear from the stranger, fear from otherness, fear from women and from men, fear from our own desires, from the desires of others, fear of contingency, fear of transiency, fear of realism, fear of death, and the last, fear of freedom. Biopolitics is the politics of frustration, for it constantly retreats from facing the world dilemma and its new manifestations in our modern times. In this point, it keeps fraternity with all kinds of politics of non-sympathy and unfreedom, also with the kind of politics which does not see value in the individual human life at all, and sacrifices it without any much further ado for the sake of a collective identity. But at this point I must stop and return to the beginning. Biopolitics is, in general, the politicizing of the body. So my conclusion is, new hitherto unseen forms of biopolitics can still be expected, also in the near future. Thank you. I mean, the decision to read rather than to speak, but we took most of it. I'm very sorry about it. So. Now, I think the next talk that says the travel, but we have first the discussion, okay? We can have another discussion about this. About this lecture. So we have a book about the same conduct of our discussion. Yeah.
Well, my question is that in respect to this paradox between the satisfaction of needs on the one hand and the freedom on the other hand, that there is a possibility of solving it in a liberal way. Like I am thinking about say a very article on two concepts on freedom. That there is maybe not the way of understanding freedom as autonomy or as an emancipatory way, but rather in a negative way. As a non-intervention, as a the end of for me to not to control myself, just to operate in this negative sense, that not question, that not coercive, and maybe it's not a way of solving this paradox, but it's a way of saying that sometimes understanding freedom as in a positive way, as an autonomy or auto-determination, it can entail problems of totalitarianism, and maybe we should be more. We shouldn't be that ambitious, and we should stay and keep on making this negative set. What do you think about this liberal focus on this issue?
First of all, you asked the question about satisfaction of needs. The needs of satisfaction of needs is totally different from the recognition of needs. If someone tells you, I need you, you can answer, I recognize your need, I understand that you need me, it's a very real need, but I'm sorry, I cannot satisfy your need because I do not need you. You can answer to this. That is, recognize the need of the other. But you say, I'm sorry, I cannot satisfy your needs. This is also in the manners of the state. One can recognize every need unless it is satisfaction of the needs. In principle, implies the use of other men as mere means. All needs can be recognized unless, in principle, their satisfaction implies to use other men as mere means. But it doesn't mean that all needs can be satisfied, because there is a scarcity in need, scarcity in love, scarcity in breath. Of course, not all needs can be satisfied. biopolitics is not problematic because it does not satisfy, but because the needs it does not satisfy, it does not acknowledge either. The needs, they decide whose needs are real and whose needs are fake, whose needs are true and whose needs are untrue. That is, there is a political decision about this is a realism, this is not a realism, this is ruining, this is not a ruining. The state, their state at this point, what is decided about the economy? As they have been decided, for example, they have no need for the OPEC, because dangerous for that, dangerous for them to listen to the OPEC. And that we have a need to cover up, and because the Sharia said so. So I speak about Iran only because I was last week there. But you come across basically evening democracy about these issues, a certain kind of needs themselves are not recognized, not satisfied, not recognized. That's not needs which are satisfied by the person who feels it, by the person who feels it. But the state will penalize to satisfy an individual is no person, and that and the satisfaction does not imply the use of other men as merely or together. Absolutely not. And this is the biopolitics start, the decision that certain needs are natural, other needs are natural. They have to prohibit unnatural needs and not want the satisfaction, but they cannot acknowledge everything. They are not real ones, they are fake, because they are sick, they are evil, they are sinful. And this is really that's the story of the Roman temple. Look, Foucault gave a very beautiful exemplification about the masturbation or colonization of the child in the times of the 19th century, which was considered the greatest sin, but the most innocent sexual activity, was considered the greatest sin. So people were constantly obeying the children in their bed, in the night, whether they commit the sin or not. And they did everything to prevent, to satisfy this sinful need, because this pizza was considered sinful, not the satisfaction. I give you an example, for Foucault's example, and you can see that the person used anyone as mere means for the satisfaction of his need, but the need, both this thing, not this thing, both as a sinful need, the satisfaction of which must be prevented by all means, from prohibited. So many sexual acts were prohibited by law for a long time. Nowadays they are less of the more, other things are prohibited, for example, smoking. Cigarettes might be a problem when I smoke or not, but I'm prohibited from smoking because the state, that state was prohibited. So, and I thought this is, I mean, not the record, not the satisfaction of me is the problem, because not all this can be satisfied. That if all this could be satisfied, then Marx would be right. Below and need satisfaction can be united, wonderful, can't be, there is scarcity. But we can acknowledge that we can say, you need this real need. I'm sorry, at the present moment, we cannot satisfy. But we recognize it. It's not the first time. It's not the same time. We are not saying it's not evil. That's the main same thing.
And what's the benefit of recognizing it?
Excuse me?
And what's the benefit of, well, our, exactly, what's the benefit?
The question of benefit is that I would say freedom, free choice, my liberty to choose my way of life is a benefit. I think that good life cannot be become a political issue. Good life is a personal issue. And it's a matter of personal choice of my way of life. And no one has the right to tell anyone that his or her personal choice is a problem, unless the person is a personal friend. You can give an advice, you can criticize your friend, you can tell a friend that is not all right, but that's not politics. Politics has no say in it. Otherwise you can give an advice, you can even say that this will make the list you see. You can tell this a friend, but it's not a political issue. That's a personal issue. That's an issue of personal communication, then personal criticism, that's all right. About liberalism, to ask the question about liberalism. Understand? It has to do with liberalism. My conception, because it's right-handed conception, in fact. It's right-handed conception. That is the absolute priority of the Romanian secondness. That's a moral conception and a political conception, right? And in, of course, Kant is a liberal, it is a liberal conception. Now, I am impressional, because that's why I told the story of Moses and Aaron and Schindler, and in the history of the great inquisitor, and that, because I think that's a paradox. That is a paradox. You are allowed to take the position of happiness as the main objective, but then you make a sacrifice, and you need to know that to make a sacrifice. You should not be so self-confident. You make a choice, and you must be aware of it that you have made a choice. That it's not taken for granted. It's not because it is superior. It's not so superior. You make a bad, terrible choice. Because life and freedom are the two highest values of modernity, are universal values. And all the universal conflicts are conflicts between life and freedom. And this conflict is we cannot solve this conflict. We cannot solve conflict. That's why we speak about the kind of a paradox. I call that man. I prefer the liberal solution, but I am only one person here because I prefer the Kantian suggestion. I would not say that everyone should prefer freedom against happiness. As an I do prefer freedom against happiness, but others can prefer happiness against freedom, but they need to know that, make a choice. Need to know that religion is something very, very precious than they have made this choice.
And maybe the same works for asceticism. You can choose, for example, to be ascetic individually, that you cannot construct the whole politics based on the grounds of asceticism.
That's okay, right.
Good population, you don't have more needs, now you will have to just to satisfy these needs that I say that you really have.
Asceticism is a practice of freedom, in fact. It's a kind of practice. You cannot ask others to practice asceticism. You cannot make a norm out of it. But those who practice asceticism, they must be aware of it that they have sacrificed something. And that must be, you must verify. Appear sacrifices. And you need to know that it is not the universal standard for everyone. You can choose me, but maybe others can choose differently.
I would put it this way. What notion of politics do you have? Because you say the definition of needs and whatever human needs and human desire should be, this should not be a matter of a decision by politics or by politicians or by. It shouldn't be a matter of politics, no. But where can we discuss about that? Because human needs are not discussed and defined by public. In the public, in the forum, is this forum already framed by political institutions?
I think basically what belongs to politics, I have in mind only liberal democratic politics, because totalitarian politics of every kind is based on the dictatorship over needs of kinds. I gave you examples. And nowadays, the totalitarian, half totalitarian societies very strongly practice violent politics without realizing there is contribution in the world, very strongly fundamentalist. So I will not speak about those politics, and you speak about the liberal democratic politics. I was a liberal politics is best a sort of environment politics. Where the citizens of the state, which are the state, some vote on the citizens, Aristotle would have had it, the citizens of the state, basically in the kind of not just discussion, but in the decision making processes, not just for decision making processes, that the majority vote comes and the minority is right is accepted, that's why democratic and liberal together decide upon the politics of the state in certain kind of matters. And I think it contrary to Hannah Arendt that even the so-called social question belongs to politics, because politics has, I say, and has a major say in the redistribution of wealth and the redistribution of equal opportunities. And politics is not including beside the traditional political activities and action. Also, the problem of how you redistribute wealth and that is leading to the chances of society, it is politics in inadequate to modernity, because the slogan of modernity requires equal opportunity. And if equal opportunity is not granted, it cannot be granted by the state, it cannot be granted by anyone. And if the state does not provide us the conditions, because certain kind of conditions which make opportunity more equal, then the politics is not adequate to the requirements and to the idea of modernity. And politics has to work on this fashion. So I do not agree with Hannah Arendt that the social issue can be excluded from political activity. But biopolitics must be included, is excluded, in my view, from a kind of liberal democratic politics. I cannot speak about the concept of the political. I wrote a paper about the concept of the political in my position, but it would be too far away to talk about it. I don't know who was first. Okay.
Far from the issue. My question is the following. How do you take, I agree with the distinction between personal, what is personal and what is political, but how do you take, in that case, the claim of feminism that it says that personal is political in Kate Miller's foundation? I know that this claim can be interpreted in a very totalitarian way. Say, I mean, there are different ways of understanding these sentences, this sentence that personal has to do with politics.
I think it's utterly wrong to say that personal is in effect as personal political, because there are these two spheres of modernity, the public sphere, the civil society sphere, the private sphere, and the political sphere, should remain distinct from each other. But can politicize certain issues of intimacy like that, but really very cautious about politicizing the intimacy, because it's very easy, leads to a kind of biopolitics and first freedom. Of course, women's greatest problem isn't intimacy, because in the political sphere, women that is they achieve a kind of equality, and we have already made great steps in achieving certain kind of equal opportunity also in the life of business and life of institutions. But in the so-called intimate life, we are far from it. We are dependent sexually, we are dependent emotionally. There's an extremely important dependency. These are the central point of feminist agenda, but not through making it a political issue. That's the first thing to do. It makes it is a personal issue. It is a personal issue, and each and every woman to make steps as against in your personal life. And together, of course, in discussing with other women, making women's issue public in a way as it can be made public in a society, but not through laws, not through legislation. You cannot design legislation that you will have sexual or emotional dependence on men. No state can legislate, even if you want the state to legislate in this issue. And that was really the family's concern. That's a common crime. It's no problem. I ask you to look at it. Personal, it's not personal. It's a common criminal activity. So, of course, it needs to be legislated against it. Stephen.
Well, I'd like to get into that as well, basically. I just wanted to, you used the example of smoking as part of the sort of politics of the biology of life over freedom. And having been a restful here last night, where I was having a pleasant meal, and the person next door was smoking, and that's something that in Australia you just couldn't do, it struck me that this smoking isn't just a personal matter, it's an interpersonal matter, right? So I don't think smoking is a particularly good example, because if we're talking about individuals involved in enjoyment of their life, there is going to be a civic discussion.
Okay, I thought about it, if it's using for cars, if you get cars cause kind of a problem for your lungs, then cigarette smoking. And what about you, alcohol beverage, which is not really that bad, in the fish can drive, but alcohol under the influence, people do things which you wouldn't do without under the influence. So it is a choice, you see, and this is what I said, the politics chooses. What is nature, what is unnatural, what is healthy, what is unhealthy, what is interpersonal, what is personal. That is a political decision. They decided not to want to be interpersonal, and drinking is not interpersonal for the time being, and driving cars and making this driving bus is certainly not interpersonal, because many people vested interest is in it. That's why they make this choice. These are manner of choice, nothing else. Of course, if I agree and grow and I am sick because of smoking, I can't have the others, and this is what we always did. I'm sorry. I feel hunger than others would immediately people who stop smoking. Why do you need rules for them?
Not necessarily.
Okay, you don't.
No, that's not true. I mean, if you have a table and you ask the person next to stop smoking, some people would, but some people wouldn't. And in that case, it's not a personal decision. That's why you need to have a civic discussion, and that's why these things, personal things, become common talk, like when the running of marriage is a reason to pin on mine, it seems to me that that's not just a personal consideration, or any of the second quality or things you were talking about. It's kind of making them political, that in this is discussing them, that the actual climate changes.
Okay, anyway, I was not discussed with anyone, because everyone prefers smoking. It was forbidden by law for the same. Because it's a habit, it's a cash flow, because I was doing. But I don't want to discuss this matter, John, because if you read this paper, there is no like, yeah, I'm sorry. We listened, let me read the last question, because it's really good now.
Well, if you smoke and then you get a cancer of lung, and you go to the, you ask your lover to have a very good hospital, very good chirurgeon to operate you at night to get, then that's money.
Okay, I'm not only in example, you can say the same. I said that the decision is yes, the other no.
But your decision, but your decision implies others, because you are waiting your police to get at night in the street looking for if you have an accident. You need your hospital to get people in the weekends. So your decision affects the other's decisions.
Life is dangerous. Yeah, I said, you're also dangerous. I said, because I would like to complete the question, but we can put it in the afternoon. Because after I speak about the master narratives, your profession, we come back to it's only about freedom, only about freedom. So you can come up with all these questions which is in your role. Because we need, I think, we will be a running thing, but latest quarter past 10, we return to the spoke about a very, very important subject matter.
Thank you.